take it away.
Thanks. So agree, ask questions. I will preface saying the results I'm talking about today, I am not part of any of these really results. And so I have read other people's papers and I'm summarizing them and telling you what I thought was interesting. And so if there are more detailed questions, that might be something I have to look up or something we can talk about later, but absolutely don't ask them, and maybe I can try to make notes of them. And so if I can't answer the question, we can certainly come back to it. So yeah, I went through the archive and kind of looked at the latest results coming from tests. I'm also part of some tests follow-up working groups, and so I know that there are lots of other paper coming down the pipeline. Just based on the things that are on the archive, in 2019 alone, there's 100 paper have tests in the abstract. and it's like the middle of April, right? And that doesn't count. There were also a lot of papers, 18. And so lots of results coming. And so this is a very biased, limited, just a few papers that I thought were particularly interesting or kind of relevant for the discussion here. Just first, a little bit of background. So this is a artist rendition of TESS. This is it's called the Transient Exoplanet Survey Satellite. It's made up of four 10.5 centimeter cameras that scan the sky in kind of these orange slices. And so this is, I think, a 24 by 96 degree slice. It started scanning the southern hemisphere, and it goes around. These are each observation sectors that are about 28 days. And then this August, I believe, it should move to the northern hemisphere. Oh, sorry, let me go back a sec. Is it going to let me go back? Yeah, so I just wanted to show that it's going to play the whole thing. Okay. I wanted to point out that unlike Kepler, which was staring at one patch of the sky and really trying to do a statistical survey of exoplanets, trying to measure A to Earth, looking for longer period planets, because of the way that the TESS mission is set up, you'll notice that for most of the sky, it's only getting about kind of these sector length observations, which are about 28 days. But there's these overlapping sectors at the bottom where you get almost 365-day coverage. These are the K2 fields, that's Kepler. And this is going to be super awesome for even more follow-up studies of exoplanets, because that's where JWST will also have almost the continuous coverage. And so one of the main purposes of TESS, as I see it, is to find planets that we can then follow up with JWST. Actually, the level one science goal of TESS, which, tell me if this makes sense to you, is to measure the masses of 50 small 4-Earth radii or less planets. And so this is a little bit weird because this is the transiting exoplanet survey satellite, and the transit method gives you the radius of the planet, not the mass. And so really built into the TESS mission is this reliance or collaboration with ground-based facilities. Right now, the main way that we measure exoplanet masses is through the radial velocity Doppler wobble method, and all of those instruments are on the ground. And so it's been a real partnership between TESS and the people who work on TESS data and the ground-based observers.
Do we know how the number 50 was decided on?
No. No, I don't know how it was decided on, and it's not like to a certain significance.
Based on like the ground-based facilities that are available that can reasonably measure masses within 2 years?
That would make sense. But I honestly don't know. And so like I said, TESS started in the southern hemisphere, where there are a variety of ground to RV facilities to measure masses, but really only two and now three that can do very high precision mass measurements of the smallest planets. There are more in the north. And so, you know, once TESS moves to the north, that should be, we see this high number of TESS planet papers now, and it should only increase once TESS moves to the north. That's what I think.
When is it going to move to
the north? So it's supposed to be 1 year in the south and 1 year in the north, and it started real scientific observations, I think, in August last year in the south. And so after like a few months of commissioning, it launched in April last year. Mm-hmm. I forget the exact date, but it might be very close
around
to now.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes.
Do you know if any decisions about TESS extended mission?
No. I don't know if any decisions have been made. That's like basically as soon as it launched, they were starting to think about the extended mission, and there's a whole working group on that. They had a what's it called? Senior review due to NASA, I think in February or March. And so I don't know the result of that.
What are the popular ideas?
I think the popular ideas are continuing the all-sky aspect of TESS, but maybe actually going back to the ecliptic where K2 is observed. Right now, TESS is avoiding, basically doesn't get very much coverage during of that region. And the thought is, well, you know, now K2 is done, so why not revisit those fields to extend the coverage of the things that were detected there? I think that's generally what they're thinking.
Would it tilt and then just have the long axis just to the ecliptic?
Yeah.
Cool.
That was the
moment.
So interesting, only 6 months in the ecliptic. All right, so let's
April
see.
April 18th
That could be the theme of tonight's barbecue. Oh, and I just also wanted to point out that basically the photometric precision that they thought, they predicted that TESS would achieve, it's reaching that. Not for all targets, but for kind of the baseline, most of the targets, it's meeting, if not exceeding, expectations. And so that's great. Okay. Yes.
Can we just make a quick comment on that? Another feature is that their pointing is much better than they expected.
Yes.
That compressed the data more. So currently, I think they have 200,000 postage stamps per sector.
Mm-hmm.
They think they might be able to increase that in the extended mission.
Yes, they were. I think they were thinking in the extended mission that right now there's, I kind of said this in the title, but there's the 30-minute full-frame images of the entire, all the stars that TESS is observing, and then the 200,000 postage stamps that get two-minute cadence. And I have heard that they were thinking even for the postage stamps, maybe it could be even higher cadence, and for the whole sky, it could also be higher cadence than 30 minutes, which is like, so exciting, so much science. Okay, focusing on planets, sort of. I put my talk together, and then last night I was like, I don't have time, NC, I have to put this in, because this was the first TESS planet announced, and so it came from two different papers, one kind of from the TESS team and one from outside of it, and that's because the RV data that was used in this paper to constrain the mass of the planet was archival. There are some HARPs, and then also AAT data. The precision of the AAT data is not so good, but they can still use it. And this is actually a known planet system. It has this long period giant planet. It's something like 10 Jupiter masses at 3.1 AU, high eccentricity. That was known in the early 2000s from the Anglo-Australian survey for planets just using radial velocities. But then, just from the first sector of TESS data alone, this other small planet popped out. I don't even have it written down. You know, relatively small period. This is just from one sector, 28 days of data. And you can see here, the radius of the planet puts it right around a little bit more than 2 Earth radii. And from the Kepler mission, we know that actually planets around this size are the most common type of planet. At least within 100 day periods. But what was super exciting for me is the y-axis of this plot, which the magnitude of this star, the visual magnitude, is 5.67. And so, like, you can see this with your eye. And I remember, you know, the TESS alerts came out, I think actually the same day as the National Academy's report on exoplanet science strategy. And so I was like, I don't know what to read. So I went with the TESS alerts, more important. And I just saw this, like, pop up right at the top of the list, like a super Earth planet around a 5.6 magnitude star in the Southern Hemisphere, where I have access to telescopes. Very, very exciting. And really what TESS promised, right? It promised to find small planets around bright stars. Great. Check. And so pi MNC falls kind of in this regime of the mass radius diagram. And so it probably doesn't have as similar a composition to Earth, right? It's both more massive and larger. But understanding this planet more would really benefit from more like atmospheric observations to understand what the composition of the likely envelope is. of this planet.
I was always curious about that. So the mass was measured using archival RVs.
Right? That is correct. All archival.
Yeah, so presumably if you took a periodogram, you would get a peak at that period. But people didn't believe it before because they didn't know there's a transiting planet there.
Right.
But, I mean, the mass is pretty well measured. Right?
Yeah.
Why wasn't it picked up from just the RVs?
Well, hang on. You've got the period. If you've got two transits, which you will have, the period is 6 point something days. So they'd have the period. And the significance of a peak at a known period is way more than the significance of a peak in a whole periodogram, right? If you do a periodogram with 10,000 frequencies, you've got 10,000. You know, you've got to have much.
But the single peak still has the same significance.
No, it doesn't. No, it doesn't.
I'm not sure there is.
At a known period, you just have to say, would the noise produce a peak of that height at that period, with, you know, less than 1 in 1,000 chance? The same height peak in a periodogram of 1,000 periods, you'd expect one.
Okay.
So knowing the period makes it much easier to identify. I mean, you look at that, it's a really low amplitude.
But I don't have the periodogram here. I also don't know actually how, because there's like something like 70 or 80 RVs total, spanning something like 10 years. And so this is a very short period planet, and the sampling of the RVs is not very good. And so I actually don't know if you only had the RVs if you would have been able to pick it out. I didn't go back and, I would have to look at the periodogram.
It'd be interesting to know how much detrending has gone into that as well.
Yeah.
If they sort of decorrelate.
Well, so interestingly, the astute among you will notice a purple star in the corner of this plot, and I have put purple stars in the corners of plots for targets that I'm following up with a RV survey with Tess. And so our data are not included in this paper because we've been taking new data on it. This wasn't, surprisingly, a target in our long-term survey. But we are now getting more RV data on this. And so it's more contemporaneous with the Tess photometry. And so we might be able to better account for any sort of stellar activity in the RVs by using the photometry as a as an answer for what the star is doing by itself.
So can you tell us again, what are the periods of the two planets?
Yes. So this, I don't have it written down. I have this is at 3.1 AU, and the period of Pi Mensae.
You can see it on the x-axis there.
Oh, yeah, you're right. You're right. Yeah.
Days,
yeah, of course. Yeah. So quite different. Yes, and this is like 0.63 eccentricity.
I was going to say with follow-up radial velocities, do you actually get reasonable constraints on the eccentricity?
Yeah, this is what I was going to say. So our RVs, our new RVs, like serendipitously fall like here and like here. So you get that peak in the long period planet very well, but that's actually. I think it's causing the RV derivation. Sorry, Jim. Of the RVs to be impacted because these are all relative measurements. We're using the iodine cell, and so we actually see the RVs taken kind of at this time, like beads on a string for Pi Mensae. But when we add in the additional data and re-derive the RVs as you do with the iodine method, then there's larger errors and it kind of messes up the fit. And so it's clearly very important to include this planet. That's not a surprise, but really including the long period planet is going to be critical for getting the right semi-amplitude of the smaller planet. Yeah.
So are they coplanar? Does that long period planet transit?
That's a fun idea.
Is it exosphere transit or something like that?
Yeah, I don't remember.
I'm asking you, Joanna.
Yeah. I don't remember either paper talking about, calculating or, trying to estimate whether that would happen. It's a very long period. But it's also very massive, so probably has a pretty large. I mean, it's 10 Jupiter masses.
10 Jupiter.
That's true, yeah.
At that period, I think the transit probability is
very low.
But the magnetosphere transit probability is pretty high.
The magnetosphere?
Yeah. Because that's...
But what would we see from that?
I don't know. We have an hour and a half.
so, So I can put it in and out of the KOPS mission, which is to exactly do things like that. And so KOPS is a 45 centimeter telescope, but it's going to be in low Earth orbit, but it's specifically to actually follow up radial velocity curves like that to see if things are transiting. Whether it will actually transit during when KOPS is up, we'll find out.
Yeah.
Just one other comment. I mean, if you didn't have the transits and you only had the ROVs, you might think that C was a satellite of B, right?
You might think that C was a satellite of B.
You have to get the dipole gravitational, because you have this going around the star, so you have to have some sort of dipole gravitational.
So rephrase it as a question.
I don't think so.
No, because that would be like an exomoon, and there's been models to show that, because you'd end up seeing wobbles like within it, like so it'd be.
I think you would.
Yeah, exactly. Not between the B and the C.
Well, but you're saying that over top of this is planet C.
Right.
Which is in the signal, total signal.
The RV signal you'd get from a satellite.
It'd be a dipole gravitational signal, which would be very small compared to just the center of mass of the planet and satellite system.
Okay.
It'd do something, but I don't think it'd be a meter per second. Hmm.
Yeah, and this is several meters per second.
It'd be like a tidal.
Yeah.
Gravitational force on the star.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. That's going to be tough. Unless, like, one of those things is a neutron star.
This, is slightly cooler than, or no, slightly warmer than solar star. Okay, so, super exciting. Small planet, bright star. What comes next? Dan's paper! So if you have any questions, he's sitting right here. I said at the beginning, like, this is obviously a biased talk, but I really thought this was, like, one of the more exciting papers that has come out in the last year. So I think I'm also a co-author on it. Because we got some IRTF, spectra of this object. So this is the TOI 197.01, the first transiting planet identified by TESS for which astroseismology of the host star was possible. And so you see the power spectrum there, made from the corrected light curve, showing the granulation background and the power excess due to the oscillation here. Such a nice little pretty bump. And I'm not an expert in astroseismology, so if you have any questions about that, you can ask Dan. But what stood out to me, or what I was excited about, was that one, okay, this is like behaving as we might expect. It falls kind of right in the parameter space where we think solar type slightly evolved solar type stars should be in terms of the frequency and the amplitude. But so it's kind of regular in this sense, but it's very irregular in the planet host sense. So in terms of the temperature and radius of the star, there just aren't that many planets that we know of around stars that are like this. Because of the astroseismology, the radius of the planet can be measured very precisely. I think there were also, I forget if there were archival RVs on this, but you,
no.
Okay, so these are all new RVs. So we also have a mass, and that's a more precise density. And so this is falls here, and the mass radius diagram, sorry. And so it's one of the most precisely characterized Saturn-sized planets to date. With a density measured to about 15%. It doesn't follow the trend that we've seen in slightly smaller planets of increasing planet mass with, slightly mass and more massive planets, increasing planet mass with host star metallicity. And that also seems to be, I think, a trend that Eric Prediger has seen in terms of radius and small planets. And so that's a little bit interesting. The metallicity of the host star is consistent with zero, but it has a mass consistent with 60 Earth masses. And so what Dan says in the paper is that maybe Saturn-sized planets follow a relatively narrow range of densities, and that this might be a signature of the transition in the interior structure of the planets, leading to different mass-radius relations for sub-Saturns versus Jupiter mass planets. And I thought it was an interesting suggestion that this object could be a precursor to the population of planets that we see, the gas giant planets that undergo radius reinflation due to the increased flux from their host star as the host star goes up the red giant branch.
The paucity of in the HR.
These are known host stars, by the way.
Yeah, known host stars and transits.
Yeah.
So there's actually quite a large population of RV planets around the ball of stars that has been found through RV surveys, including much more ball of stars. And there's quite a bit of discussion now whether some of these are real. I think Andreas Grünbach and his group have a few papers where they now believe that actually they followed it up longer and it's not quite phase stable, so perhaps it's some long-periodic pulsation for the star. But obviously, you have the transits. You can, in terms of, once you try to find transit planets around very small stars, you're fighting against the fact that the star is just larger than the transit bit.
Right.
So that's why it stops. The largest point on this diagram is Kepler 91, which is still the largest known star with a transit.
How large is that planet?
About 8 or 9, something.
Okay.
What's the orbital period of this one?
About
16
days.
Yes.
16? What would the star have looked like before it was a subgiant when it was on the main sequence?
It's about 1.2 solar masses.
So like F.
So it's not quite what you would call a retired A star, like a star that was very massive and then had a very different rotation history than.
So that's sort of a findable system, isn't it, on the main sequence? Mid F star with a Saturn-type planet around it.
That's very findable.
It's interesting that orbital period that would make this a sort of a warm Saturn around a subgiant, and those planets appear to be quite rare from RV surveys.
Mm-hmm.
Very few massive planets on, 10 to 100-day orbital periods around subgiants. This is an exception to that.
This is something you find when you do big area surveys. So in the WASP survey, this is the way you said it. It's when you go really wide area, you find bright but rare things. And so it does enable you to sort of probe sort of extremes of the parameter space, things like this. There might only be one or two of these on the sky, but you'll see it. Right?
Well, I mean, this popped up pretty early, so I'm not quite sure how we really understand how rare planets are and the evolution of the star. The RV surveys didn't find a whole lot. In fact, when we proposed a similar program for K2, it got shut down by panels every time because everyone was like, RV surveys didn't find any closest planets around the bulk stars, hence they don't exist. But we did actually find quite a few around basically stars at the base of the RGB. So this is the work that my student Sam Grunblatt did at PhD. And he's working right now, in fact, on a paper to do planet occurrence.
Yeah.
And if you look at planet occurrence of these, hot Jupiters around the more evolved stars compared to the ones in the main sequence, it's actually not that different. I mean, small number statistics, right?
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't look like the whole picture of, closing planets get swallowed up or in spiral.
Right.
At least it doesn't happen at the base of the RGB or before then. It happens later.
How many solar radius does the planet also, some of the gap there is a selection because nobody looked at those subjects.
Yes, very, very much so.
Yeah.
But Tess is looking.
So this is a 16-day period?
Yeah.
There is this claim from Schlafman and Wynn a while ago that massive planets around subgiants are rare.
Yeah.
And that you can explain it if you have some extremely large tidal dissipation in the star, and it's sort of, and there's been some other work on that, but if that absence of those planets is actually not real, that would be really interesting.
Yeah.
I'm not sure we understand it as well. I think it's the papers.
I'm sorry, what was your point about the density of this planet being sort of transition between the Jupiter?
So there was a paper by Eric Pedigora that measured a whole bunch of masses for these sub-Saturns, as he called it, so in between Neptunes and Saturns, and you can see that they have a wide range of masses at a given radius. You can actually, this is actually cut by the precision in the density, so you can see that it spreads out. And he found that the masses of the planets are quite heavily correlated with the metallicity of the whole star. There's a strong correlation to plot.
The iron of the host star, right?
Yes. Yeah. That's what. And this one doesn't quite follow that. It's more massive than its metallicity would imply if you would apply that relation that Eric found to the sub-Saturns to this planet. And it's not quite a sub-Saturn, you see, but the symbol is actually, you know, its radius is more compatible with a Saturn-sized planet. And so the idea is that the mass-radius relation, as you see, sort of transitions where you go between the Neptunes and the Saturns, you have a mass-radius relation, and then for the Jupiter-sized planet, it turns over. So the idea, what, you know, we discussed in the paper, is that you can actually measure the densities, the masses, and the radii both for a lot of these planets in this transition very precisely. Maybe map out the transition in the mass-radius relation between Saturns and Jupiters.
So you think that while the star swells up, nothing is happening to the planet?
Well, it depends. So we do know that as the incident flux increases, the planets get larger. Mm-hmm. Right, so this well-known effect here, that you have larger incident fluxes and the Jupiter's inflate. And there's some theories that tie that to stellar evolution, the incident flux will also increase. So you would expect that the star evolves and the incident flux increases dramatically, and the radius would respond to the planet, and it would also start to inflate. But this one is not yet at that regime, right? It sits at the bottom of this inflation sequence. So it shouldn't be, the radius of the planet shouldn't be inflated because of the fact of things.
But that, some people can do it. So has anybody put that, like this increase in flux from the star and see what it does to the...
Yes, so Eric Lopez has, Jonathan Horton had a paper that suggested that you can actually use this as a test case to explain what might actually be causing the inflation of Jupiter's, whether it's... essentially, the theory behind how you can make a planet inflate because of the incident. I mean, the observational fact is that large influxes inflate planets. The question is how does the energy actually get to the interior of the planet to heat it up and make it inflate? And one way you could potentially do this is to look for planets that have been reinflated, that essentially formed, cooled down, and then as the star evolves up the RGB, the incident flux goes up again, and it re-inflates the planet to a large radius.
This supposed gap that Sam showed in 2018 might not be so real anymore, with a dearth of planets at short radii. It's not necessarily explained entirely by tides, but also potentially by formation mechanisms for higher mass stars. I mean, traditionally, those have been the two competing sort of theories about why this gap sort of existed.
Dan, what do you think the prospects are of measuring internal rotation of this subgiant?
We don't have enough data on this one.
So far. Single sector, so.
We've looked in the six sectors. If we search the six sectors, you can start to see them really splitting, so we'll definitely get it from the ones we have in here. Mm-hmm.
This is right at the frequency where they're extremely interesting, because Kepler didn't get many.
Yeah.
Because these require short
waves. But you need the continuous fields.
Yeah.
What, so this is in camera four?
No, this one is, we only have one sector of data.
One sector.
And that's all you're going to get.
But this is a very typical star where we expect to do astroseismology. So if you look at the, our predictions are that most stars we can do astroseismology on not fall essentially here.
Mm-hmm.
So a very, very small number of mid-sequence stars.
Sorry, not knowing much about stars for the stars expert, when as the star fills up, can you get a lot of UV and X-ray winds? Can you get very high energetic winds from the star? Or
most of them, they're spinning down, so they're slowing down, so they're spinning less fast, you have less UV activity. They're spinning down actually faster than we thought they would, so there's even less than you would think. They're not very spotted, like giants, 2% of them have spots, so it's not a very large population. So most of them won't be heavily radiated by an energy standard.
Are there questions about their masses, kind of, is that debate gone? Away the masses of the subgiants, the fact that you do it with isochrones, is that?
That's a complicated story. There's still two camps. I think what we now believe is that, so this is the retired AB star mass debate. What we now believe is that for the So we've done a whole bunch of seismology to check this, and if the spectroscopic prediction was that they're very massive, then it was overestimated, but at the spectroscopic prediction was that they were lower mass, around 1.5, then it was okay. But at 1.8, so say in the retired A-star studies, if something has a mass of 1.8 or so, then it's probably more like 1.5, and it was definitely overestimated. But so over, I guess one other way of saying it is that the amount of air in the mass increases with mass.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So it's not black and white of saying all of them are overestimated by 50%.
But there was this idea that the two solar mass ones were actually 1.1.
But it is a function of mass as to how overestimated mass.
Sorry, just to insist on this point. So I haven't looked at the work from Lopez and Fortney to see how, if you could rewind the clock, how big that planet would be to see where it would sit. So, because right now that's the radius, because it's an inflated planet.
But this one is not really inflated.
And most of these on this plot are most of these Jupiters around main sequence.
Yes, actually, I mean, it's
Like right, that's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
Like, you're comparing two things. You're comparing the ones in main sequence with the ones that could have gone some process. Anyway.
Yeah, I don't know how many in this corner. Well, you can kind of, sort of tell, it can't be that many that are up here that are around now subgiant stars.
Right. Yeah, it's color code. Subgiants are, I guess the red ones are more. So these are actually full-fledged.
SWRGB
giants, and there are a couple that are inflated Jupiters around actual red giants. And we have done the calculations. We, as you say, rewind the clock and say what was the radius evolution as a function of age, because we know the mass of the star pretty well, so you can predict quite well what is the incident flux history on the planet.
And when you do that, you still would predict that there was a transition in the mass radius. That's what I'm trying to get to.
You can't predict the radius inflation because we don't know what causes it.
Well, assuming
you assume a model.
If you say if it's only from incident flux, then you can go backwards and say, okay, what is the radius of this planet before the star swelled? And then you can put it in that mass radius and see where it lies.
But it's a little bit awkward because there's only an empirical relationship there between incident flux and planet radius, right? And you don't have the physics behind that, so you don't know how it varies with, for example, the spectrum of the radiating flux or the type of planet.
Right, so I'm just saying, so from all the
if you assume radius, a model.
Yeah, you can assume, from so the reason, how we get inflation in planets or how that was first observed, that you get a theoretical model for the radius and then the actual radius is above that. So and then we can go into trying to explain. So I'm trying to say the same thing. If we just use the spherical model, now we put it at this the planet around the star that has more incident flux, is this really theoretical basis, where would it lie?
I mean, I think with these, it would evolve them back to being a Jupiter size, essentially, instead of 1.4, instead of being inflated above. I mean, I don't know what the inflation threshold is where you start calling it a Jupiter and inflate. You're clear.
Mm-hmm.
You can't explain it anymore. Mm-hmm. So I think it's something like maybe 10% the size of Jupiter. It's 10% large, like larger than 10%, and you could call it.
But looking at the bottom, that's mass versus radius. There are plenty of gray points. Mm-hmm. That still show this transition, and those are around, not subgiant stars. You were talking about the mass radius relation.
Yeah. So there's a spread. And so I don't know if those are planets that are. So those are dwarfs. Those are normal.
Yeah.
Those are around normal stars.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry. What is the transition?
So I think we're talking about.
You have to
I see. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So it's a change in slope.
Yeah, change in slope. And do you remember where, so the Chen and Kipping paper that tries to parameterize the mass radius relation is, do you know, remember where the knee is?
I don't exactly know. That's what I think. Okay. Yeah. I mean, they essentially did the same thing.
Yes.
They take very well measures. And then empirically say, this is where the data shows this transition.
And actually, that's a physical change, isn't it? That transition is going from electrostatic support to generate.
Yeah, that's what Dan is. Yeah,
which is why it's flat. And
exactly, that's why you can have a 10 mass, 10 Jupiter mass planet, and same radius.
Okay.
But they didn't test it. But I mean, these for this system, right? We got the RVs in like 2 weeks because the star was so bright. It kept you for like a minute to get an RV point, right? We got 100 RVs in a very short amount of time because it's so bright. You can really hammer the star, get the only masses very well. And then if you know the star well, then you can get.
Isn't that a bad idea to have orange exposures, because then you actually sample the gravitation?
That's what I was going to ask. How do you...
Exposures to average out instead of pulsation.
Yeah, you can average over. You can still do...
Okay, so you...
If you have the stellar power spectrum from the test observations, then can't you explicitly model some of your pulsations?
Modes aren't coherent over time. So they're like stochastic, like sinus. You could do some sort
Like not coherent at all, or like over what time scale? Because if the RVs are taken over 2 weeks.
Days, weeks.
Okay. Okay.
So the lifetime of the modes depends on the luminosity of the star, essentially. So it's longer, the higher you go up on the RGB, the longer the modes are. So for the sun, the mode lifetimes are days, like giants, 3 weeks. But yes, we have not contracted actually. If anything more sophisticated than model of Jita term in the RVs.
Yeah.
But that's, of course, that's the downside, right? You say, okay, you can do astroseismology, hence you know the star level,
yes.
But then the star also
isn't very well behaved.
Chance
of might
want to model out. Yes, me too.
Okay.
Is that coherence? I'm just being set by sort of a conductive turnover somewhere?
It's not quite the turnover, but yes. It's something to do with the convection and the mode damping, because we don't really understand how the modes get damped.
Yeah, it's a damping.
Yeah.
It's messy because they're sort of both driven and damped by convection at the same time. So you can think of that as a damping timescale.
So if the photon noise is tiny because they're so bright, and the modes decohere over a few weeks, ultimately, how accurately are you going to get the RV?
It's a good question. I mean,
I don't remember. Do you remember what the residual was on the fit here?
Yeah, a few meters per second.
Okay.
So we know roughly for a given star where it is in the, in its evolution, what the expected jitter from the star or
right.
a given time scale should be.
Right.
So predict that based on the observations that we already have and some empirical understanding of how the amplitude scales with just sort of the bottom left plot. So essentially saying if you go up left is the RGB. You know, the luminosity amplitude, you can translate that into velocity amplitude.
Jamie wrote a paper about it.
Yeah. So you have some expectations to how it should be. For this particular star, it's on the order of 3 meters per second, essentially. So that sets a limit, in terms of how
much. It would lose your advantage of being able to get 100 RVs in 2 weeks, but you could invest in taking many observations in a row, potentially. And then even if the phase is completely incoherent from one night to another night, within the night, presumably, at least there's enough phase coherence to model based on the mode frequencies that you know. So I guess what I'm saying is with a different observation strategy, it's possible that you could crack below that 3 meters per second.
Right. Yeah, that's something I think that needs to think more about observing strategies of how to actually, rather than just say, okay, we'll observe it once a night or
yeah.
tonight. We haven't really thought about it at all.
We are trying, so the survey I'm doing, we're trying to think about it, so you can ask me about it. Okay, notice this does not have a purple star, so we're not observing this. Sorry. It is pretty cool. Okay, so great discussion. This is super, super great. Okay, so this next one that I wanted to highlight. So this is a two-planet system. This is the one that was detected by TESS. It's an ultra-short period planet, so it's a one-day period, super Earth-sized planet, kind of right in the middle of, for those of you familiar with the radius gap, right in the middle there. But this team also found, or they think they have found, a non-transiting planet using the RV data. And so these ultra-short period planets are interesting because they're somewhat rare. They're about as rare as hot Jupiter planets, based on what we know from the Kepler mission. And if you have, it appears that these very short period planets seem to have larger inclinations And so, let's see, what did they say? The inclination between orbits of multi-planet systems appear to be larger for shorter period planets in tight orbits. And if this is indeed like a dominating effect in these ultra-short period systems, then it means that finding transiting planets in these multi-planet transiting systems might be intrinsically harder in these ultra-short period systems because of this high mutual inclination. Okay, so they tried modeling just the light curve, the test light curve, just the RBs, and then modeling them together. Nestor Espinosa is the first author of this paper, and he actually wrote a wrapper called Juliet that enables you to model jointly the RBs and the transit light curve. So let's see, they tried just fitting just photometry, they tried it with just a transit model and with a transit plus a Gaussian process model to account for the correlated noise. They basically find that's indistinguishable based on model evidence, so they just start, for their light curve model, they use a model without the Gaussian process, but they still have a white noise component for the photometric jitter. Looking at just the RV fit, they tried first with capillaries with circular orbits. They find that this two-planet model, so the transiting planet, but then also a slightly longer period planet, has a higher evidence than just the one-planet model. And they say, you know, bring up the question, well, could this 4.75-day period be caused by stellar activity? But they think that's really unlikely because they estimate the rotation period from the star something like 19 days from the V sine I measurement spectroscopically. They also don't find any peak in the periodogram of the stellar activity indicators around this period. And so this is more evidence that they think this is a real planet and not stellar activity. Then they move on to do a joint fit of the photometry and RV. And so I think that's the result of this plot. And so in this plot, they have the different Pharos and Harps RVs. They have the full model in black, the Keplerian component in blue, and then their Gaussian process model in red. And interestingly, I think they... I'm trying to remember, it might be a different paper. I'm trying to remember, I think in this paper, because they're using Juliet, Nestor has written the code such that you can jointly model both the light curve and the radial velocities with a Gaussian process that uses hyperparameter information from the light curve and applies that to the Gaussian process for the RV. So I think that's what they've done here. So kind of tying the light curve and the RVs together. The GP component is explaining the stochastic variation with a typical time scale of 3 hours and an amplitude of roughly 2 meters per second. So they think that's unlikely to be oscillation because it's too large of an amplitude and too long of a time scale, but think that maybe it's modeling some of the instrumental noise because the Pharos data are actually not that high precision. So that's all like background on the modeling. And there's lots of details in this paper. It's very comprehensive, so it's a good one to read over.
So the red line is describing not the star, but what the star is doing, but what they think the instrument.
Well, so they're not sure. It's you know, correlated noise. And so I think they still include like a white noise jitter term, but they don't know exactly what it's not obvious what the GP is accounting for, if that makes sense, because they think the rotation period of the star is something like, 18 days. And this has a typical time scale of more like 3 hours.
It is kind of following the residuals, the Pharos residuals.
Yeah, like, exactly.
If you look at like what direction the rotation is going, it's like looking at the outliers of the black
planets. Yeah.
I'm trying to understand the motivation here. Why not just leave them as residual? Is it helping your RV fit?
Yeah. Using the Gaussian process?
I mean, is it helping your, of course it's helping the fit, because anytime you add things you help the fit.
Right.
Is it helping your...
the accuracy?
Your mass?
Yeah.
It will, I think it helps the precision, but I don't know about actually the accuracy.
I mean, what it should, if you just ignored, if you just
treated them as independent observations instead of taking correlated noise into account, then it would make your error bars overly confident. And so adding a gaussing process like this should propagate uncertainty from the fact that they're residuals.
Okay, so now each one of those data points
is going to contribute a little less to the fit.
Okay, yeah. What I was going to ask is, it's estimating the correlated noise. So typically we assume those error bars are uncorrelated.
Exactly, yeah.
So they're taking the GP and pumping it back in to add correlations between the
two. I expect so. I would expect that that's what's happening.
Okay, that's fine.
And so the non-transiting, how far away is the non-transiting?
How far away? I don't have that written down. It's 4.7578 days. I forget what kind of star this is.
I think it's sun-like.
So when I think it's sun-like star.
It's like 6 days, so they're still.
Yeah, they're still both very short period. So they point out. First of all, let me talk about the plot in the right. They point out that. 141B, so the one that is transiting, and they have the radius, is similar in radius to 55 Cancri E, which is one of the most famous transiting exoplanets in the multi-planet system. It was kind of one of the first transiting super-Earths, I think. Also very hot, very, very short orbital period. And Spitzer observations of the light curve have indicated, I think they, like, one interpretation is it has, like, a lava surface that's, like, patchy. And so they think, oh, this would be interesting to get similar observations to compare to this kind of benchmark system. The star is not as bright as 55 Cancri, but it's the brightest ultra-short period planet host star after 55 Cancri E. And this planet is slightly denser than 55 Cancri E, but has a similar level of stellar irradiation. And so they suggest that atmospheric characterization will be challenging, but they think that something like 10 transits could detect the occultation of 3 sigma significance. And they actually say that the fainter nature of the star might be advantageous for HST transmission observations because it's not going to saturate. And so then they do this interesting twist that I'm very keen on learning more about or talking more about, which is using the stellar abundances to try to constrain more about the interior composition of the planet. And so if any of you know Caroline Dorn and her work, she is a co-author on this paper, so it's really based on her models of the interiors of planets. They have these different interior parameters, kind of the radius of the core versus the full solid part of the planet, the iron-to-silicon ratio of the mantle, the magnesium-to-silicon ratio of the mantle, and the full density of the planet. And what they find is, using kind of Earth-like constraints, the bulk abundance constraints can't be reconciled with the actual measured density of the planet, which is 1.66 times that of the Earth. And so when they place these Earth-like constraints and constraints on the abundance ratios from the star, they aren't able to match the density of the planet, but they relax those, specifically the iron to silicon constraint, and so they let that be whatever, they don't say it has to be the same as the star, they're able to better actually match the measured density of the planet. And so they suggest that this is pointing towards some difference in the core of the planet. It's allowing for a larger core mass fraction. They say it remains unclear how such iron-rich interiors can form, but that maybe it might be helpful to include lighter elements in the core. They're just assuming a purely iron core. But by including lighter elements, like I think we know is true in the Earth's core, this allows for larger cores and thus higher bulk densities. And so they suggest in this paper that, like, maybe this slightly roundabout way is a way to constrain the amount of light elements in a core of an exoplanet. And I was like, wow, that would be super cool. But I was struck by how they really, you know, there's been kind of an interest in the community of using the stellar abundances to constrain the more detailed properties of the planets, but in this case, it doesn't quite work, because they say, well, we can't actually match the density that we've measured for the planet if we assume that the iron to silicon ratio of the planet has to be this within the range that we have measured for the star.
What is it for the sun? Like, does it match the Earth at all?
Yeah, it does. There is a specifically magnesium to, so I'm working on it, so that's the magnesium to silica, no, the magnesium to iron ratio is matches better than the if you include silica, so silica to magnesium, silica to iron, because silica is a little bit of a volatile, so we expect it to, you lose it a little bit during formation. And we talked about this, can you actually point where in that figure, because it's not the red one, is it? Is it the red
one? The red one is the new one that they're adding.
That's the red one?
This is the one that they're saying, yeah.
Okay, so and they're saying it has the same radius as 55 Cangri?
Yes, it does.
Okay, but 55 Cangri E, so...
No, a similar something. Radius.
So this is weird. The 55 Cangri E is above, is right at the threshold of rocky and
so it must,
gaseous.
Maybe it's this one? Because there's small planets with known masses. No, it must, ultra short period planets. It's ultra short period, so it must be.
It's probably one of those.
Okay.
So, sorry, what is it? It says Earth-like and then 100% rock. Okay, yeah. So
yeah.
It's one of those.
Okay.
And it depends on who you believe, because the original, the first. Joshua, I think, puts it right in the middle, in the threshold. And then Breeze Demery, and what's the other person? They did two studies.
Right.
It's above.
Right.
And so we really don't know if that planet has an envelope or not. Mm-hmm. So what's interesting is to see, again, if the phase curve, I agree, if the phase curve is similar to this planet, because this planet could have, could be rocky, certainly could be rocky.
Yeah.
And the fact that it's a little bit more compact than Earth-like, it means that it would have a little bit more iron.
Mm-hmm.
But so this is my criticism. I don't know why people, and it started a trend saying you can take the star's composition and then use it for exoplanets, and that's not true.
There's been a lot of models who showed that that's actually a decent way to go. I mean, it's not perfect. It's definitely not perfect. It doesn't account for like multiplanetary systems, but that it's a good starting block for trying to understand the composition of planets.
Not really. I mean, look at the
variation. Did a study that was one of like a whole bunch in 2000.
But how do you know? Like, how would you say that is actually the right?
I think they're benchmarked on the solar system usually.
Yeah, they're usually benchmarked off the solar system.
So
and Caroline also did a similar sort of thing.
Right. So you have Mercury.
Yeah, I know. That's what Larry Nittler always says
Mercury.
To me.
What's
up with Mercury?
It's not just about multiplanetary systems. Even if they're not multiplanetary systems, these planets, you could have ejected a planet. We know that part of forming rocky planets, they go under giant impact collisions.
Yeah.
So just taking the composition of the star, I mean, if you don't have anything, I mean, why not? But to use that to then constrain the volatiles, you're putting a lot of uncertainty layers to try to get to.
There are, but it's all we have right now because we can't actually measure the surface of an exoplanet. So at least trying to understand, and what Caroline does is a Bayesian statistical analysis using a lot of the different uncertainties built into it. And so that's why you have actually fairly large error bars on her numbers, because she's trying to incorporate that into her models.
But I like this. But I guess what I'm interested in is like what they for this they have to relax a constraint to
right.
make it work.
But it's true. But you only use like three elements here, and
yes.
like then you have Kamen Unterborn, who uses like a number of other
That's
ones,
right.
which I think sort of implies that those are important now to take into consideration.
Not really. When it comes to the radius, the most important ones are
iron, silica.
Magnesium and silica. You can interchange almost this iron. It's iron to the other ones. The other ones, calcium, aluminum, titanium, all of that, they don't have an impact on the radius, not the one that we can measure. So,
but then you have things like phosphorus, which do contribute to the core of the planet, and they're not taken into account.
Sorry,
here.
What?
Phosphorus.
Phosphorus doesn't really enter the core of the planet.
It's sulfur, oxygen,
sulfur, carbon.
Right, but
why do you say phosphorus?
Because I'm also dealing with elements that are important for life, so that phosphorus is one of the key things that I've been looking at.
We don't have phosphorus in the core. If we do, nobody proposes this phosphorus is in the core of the Earth, making the 10%.
I'm not saying it's 10%. I'm just saying the majority of phosphorus that exists on the Earth is in the core.
It doesn't have an impact on the radius. And if
that's fine. That wasn't okay. I spoke inappropriately. I'm not trying to say that it affects the radius. I'm just saying that there are a number of lighter elements that are in the core But I do think that things like other than magnesium, silicon, and iron are important to take into account, and I think this is ultimately what we're seeing.
Not for their radius, that's what I'm trying to say. So they are important for other things, but not for, they don't have.
I think this paper is actually saying that they are, important to take into account.
So are they doing anything more than magnesium and iron?
And so,
why is that? I mean, from the spectrum, is it just because they don't think it's important?
They're easiest to measure.
No, they're the easiest. Actually, I wrote down, because I thought Megan might be. So they're getting the HARPS, they're getting the stellar parameters from the HARPS spectra with ZASP, which I've used, but then they're getting the stellar abundances from the Pharos spectra. So they're using different spectra to get the parameters and the abundances. And like, okay, that's not horrible, but why wouldn't you use the same one? I'm not sure.
Well, I guess there are also offsets and the abundances that you measure with different mechanisms.
Well, so not only different methods, but Megan has showed that like, if you're using different spectra of the same star from a different instrument, it can make a difference.
Yeah.
And like at a look like very precision level, but so I don't know why they did that.
They actually measured the abundance that they might have pulled it from something.
No, they measured it. They used Moog and yeah. But I don't know why they used two different spectra for it. Anyway. Super interesting paper. I highly recommend going and reading it because, like I said, it really walks through both the transit fitting and the RV fitting and doing them together versus separately. Nestor has been thinking about this a lot. So, interesting paper. Any other comments on this one before I move on? Okay. How are we? When do we have to finish?
About another half hour.
Okay. Several more things to cover. We'll see. Also, purple star. So we'll get more observations. This is a target we're actually observing starting Wednesday.
So you're getting more RV data? Or
right.
More
data. RV data.
Do you know of anybody that's trying to get a phase curve for this planet?
I don't, but that doesn't mean it's not happening. I would be actually kind of surprised if it wasn't.
When was this?
This came out a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, okay.
But this planet was from early test data, so I don't have it written down, but it was from like the first and second sectors or something. So people have known about it for a while. They took a longer to write the paper because they wanted to analyze RVs. But okay, next. So I had this one next because there are two different papers on this planet as well, this planetary system, and in the De Moos et al. Paper, they do the exact same type of analysis. They have more stellar abundances, but they like literally the text is the same for the description of this type of analysis. And so I'll get to that, but it was purposeful for putting these right next to each other. So this is another system with two small planets. This is a slightly fainter. The last one was about eighth magnitude in V. This is ninth. This is a K-dwarf. This system was observed in sectors 3 and 4 and won't be observed again, so we won't be getting any more test data in the nominal 2-year mission. These planets have periods of a little bit less than 5 days, a little bit more than 17 days, and radii of 1.7 and 2.5 Earth radii. So, again, we think from Kepler there's this distribution of small planet radii as a function of occurrence, and it seems like there's a gap around 1.8 Earth radii where the occurrence of small planets seems to decrease. And the peak on one side of that is kind of super Earth dubbed planets, and the other peak is sub-Neptune planets. And so this is a system where we have two planets on either side of that gap. And so it's very interesting to study in terms of the composition of planets. And so most of the plots on this slide are from the De Moos et al. Paper, just because they were kind of prettier. Here I've highlighted from the Gandolfi paper and the De Moos paper the parameters of the planets that they kind of what I thought were the key parameters that they measure. And so you can see they mostly overlap. What's different is the mass that De Moos derives for planet C is somewhat higher. But everything, and the radius is also larger. But sort of the same, also similar in terms of the stellar parameters they derive, actually. And so again, this is kind of a nice illustration of how these are the two new planets in this system, planetary radius, they're on either side of this gap that was found by B.J. Fulton using the Kepler data. Okay, so and then...
So why do you think they have such discrepancy in the mass and the radius?
That's not a discrepancy, that's one sigma.
Yeah, so I don't actually think they're discrepant. They actually use the same R, so they're using the same test data. People reduce it in different ways, and I didn't read as much about the light curve derivation, but there could be differences in that. But for the RVs, even though they use the same archival HARPS RVs, the Damusk group uses an updated pipeline that has a better wavelength solution, and what else? Includes slightly better wavelength solution. And so even though the raw data is the RV raw data is the same in both these papers, the RV actual measurements could also be different.
But they have a slightly bigger error, right? At least in the mass?
Yes. Yeah. So they model the RVs in different ways. And so in the Gandolfi paper, they do a joint analysis of the photometry and the RVs using a code called PyNETI, which I've seen in a few other papers. And so they start trying with just two Keplerians, linear and quadratic terms for long-term trends, plus an additional coherent sine-like curve whose period is constrained by, so I think it's just constrained looking at the calcium H and K periodogram. So they say, okay, we have the two Keplerians, we have the linear and quadratic long-term trend terms, and then we're gonna put in a sine curve type thing with a period of roughly 36.5 days, because that's what we think the rotation period of the star is from the activity indicators, and that's gonna be our model. They also tried a Gaussian process model, but it's basically, I think in a paper they say, oh, we basically get the same answer. They don't have too many details about that. So that's kind of their baseline model versus the Gandolfi paper, which is this series of plots that I'm showing here, which here is kind of hard to read, but this is like the full RV data set. These are the residuals, and then this is the periodogram of the residuals. This is a result of doing the Gaussian process analysis, the regression on the RVs. They use a quasi-periodic kernel, but instead, as in the paper from Nestor, instead of training the Gaussian process and constraining the hyperparameters based on the test photometry, because these are archival radial velocity observations, they are not taken similar in time as tests. And so they thought it's not, and I've seen this in other papers, including ones that I've been on, it's not really feasible, or it's not, you shouldn't use like a Gaussian process model on RV observations with that model based on, you know, observations that were taken at a different time, because the surface of the star changes over that time period. And so instead of training their Gaussian process on the test light curve, they train it on the calcium H and K measurements, which were taken simultaneously with the RV measurements. And so that's what their fit is based on. And so how they're modeling the non-planetary aspects of the RV signal is different. And so that is probably the dominant reason why they're getting different masses. Does that make sense?
Right, so more than the mass, so if I'm as a theorist, who should I believe in terms of the error?
Well, they're consistent at one sigma. I mean, this is that's, you know, it's 2.2 plus or minus a half.
So.
But the methodology, like which one is more believable, I feel like based on my biased, whatever, reading, the Damusk analysis, as they have explained it, seems more comprehensive. Mm-hmm. That doesn't always mean it's more right, but I feel like they at least documented a better exploration of the different ways that you can model the RVs.
But I mean, I think you have to emphasize here, you know, that's the Doppler shift of a star going at more or less the speed that I can jog.
Yes.
Right, and they're agreeing. I just want to emphasize that this is how cutting edge this is, how far we've come.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is, so for the interpretation of internal structure, the error bar makes a huge difference. So even though they are agreeing, what we can interpret makes a huge difference if I believe one or the other. Or if I say, actually, let me just relax it and then put it all, then it's a wash.
Yeah.
That's why, and I know it's super hard, and it's become so unglamorous to just get one of those data points, but it's super important. I am totally with you, but from the theory, if you tell me that I can take the 0.94, I'll be happier.
Right.
But right. It doesn't seem like this.
Right.
One thing you could do is just draw two Gaussians. And then multiply.
Right, and then exactly.
And you'll have a root two smaller error.
Actually.
And not independent.
They all have the same RV.
Actually, you know what? So this might be, because I just like copy this and then change the numbers. This might be a typo. So that these are the same is suspicious to me. I think that they might actually be different. I just typed it wrong. We can look at the paper and double check.
Okay.
But for the planet, no, okay, yeah, I think I have that right, yeah. Okay, anyway, so there's two papers, they get these different results. The plot that I have from the Gandolfi paper, I thought that was interesting because basically what they're trying to do, first of all, they, unlike the DeMoose paper, they use the activity, the calcium H and K activity, and use that to place a constraint on the age of the star. And thus better, they say better constrain the like more accurate mass. The masses from, the stellar masses for both papers are basically the same. But they're interested in kind of how the star has evolved over time because they want to know for these two planets, how has the X-ray and EUV radiation that they've received, how has that changed? And they say they can't really use the present day properties of the star to infer the past high energy emission, but they do something interesting there's not a lot of detail, so I need to go read the references, but they start from the assumption that the larger planet has a hydrogen-dominated atmosphere, and they derive the history of the stellar rotation and high energy emission by modeling the atmospheric evolution of the planet with a previously cited planetary atmospheric evolution model. And so the inputs to that are the planet properties and, orbital separation and the current stellar rotation period and the stellar age and stellar mass. And so then they, basically what the output of this model is this distribution of stellar rotation rate at any given age. And so this is stellar rotation at 150 million years. And they're saying, oh, it kind of makes sense. The blue is our distribution with the green is like the 68% confidence. And then the black is a distribution of... of young stars measured from open clusters with an age of 150 million years. And so anyway, I just hadn't seen that done before, and I, like, basically using the current properties of the system, including the planet, and its measured mass and radius to try to constrain something about the past high energy radiation from the star. It was several jumps, but that was interesting, so I want to read more about that. And then again, as coming back to this table, again in the DeMoose paper, they do this similar analysis as in the previous paper. They have actually a lot more elemental abundances that they've measured, but they just focus on iron, magnesium, and silicon. And again, find that they have to relax the iron to silicon ratio so that it's not just constrained by this what's measured in the star to be able to match the densities of the shorter period planet, the less massive planet. And I wrote in capital letters, same language as previous paper. So, and yeah, they say they, based on kind of another model of atmospheric evolution, they think that the atmosphere, TOI 402.02 probably has a measurable atmosphere. And so whether that is primordial or not primordial, they say, oh, it'd be really interesting to, get more observations and look at the composition.
So given that you want to get more RV data, what's your target? How well do you think you can better constrain these?
I don't know. I don't have that number offhand. And the way that we have structured our survey is smart in some ways, but not smart in other ways. And so at least so far, we rank targets, but on a target-by-target basis versus a system-by-system basis. And so I think 402.01 is a highly ranked target based on what we're trying to do in our survey. but the other one isn't. And so we've based our observational strategy on trying to measure the mass of that planet and are trying to take into account maybe that there's another planet in the system, but not in a super smart way. So basically the answer is I'm not sure how much better we're going to be able to get. I will say, yeah, well, I mean, like zero, right? I will say these are all archival observations, right? And we're designing a strategy that's supposed to have very good coverage of the planet period as well as the stellar rotation period. And so kind of much higher cadence designed to measure the mass of this planet versus the archival observations, which weren't done to do that. And so the goal is to be better. I just don't know by how much.
And it will depend a bit on what the Stardust decides to do, right? Because the level
Completely. Yeah, I forget what they got for the jitter for this. I think it was something like 1.5 meters per second, maybe.
That was high. Season, doesn't it?
It totally. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Good luck. Hopefully you get a quiet star.
We'll see. But this is, I also wanted to bring this up because this is now one of several examples where two different groups have independently analyzed both the test data and the RVs, and for the most part are getting consistent, consistent results. There's been some discussion within the test follow-up community of like, is this a good thing or a bad thing? Like, you have two papers on the same stars, they get the same thing. Why do you have two papers? But I feel like, especially for the masses, probably also for the light curve, we're in a regime still where like it's good to have a second track, independent.
It also depends on what methods they're using. If they're using similar methods, then you would expect them to get the same results. If they use the same models for the star, for example,
you
would expect them to agree.
Right.
I think it's really important that these data analysis methods now, they're really sophisticated, but there's a lot of ways to trip up, right? And so, if anybody's out there refereeing papers where it's like the third analysis of this one, why not? I mean, of course, it makes it harder for the theorists because then you never, you can say it makes it harder or easier. It makes it
if it's converging, it's easier.
They will differ by one and a bit signal sometimes. And so you have to, I suppose you should analyze both, which is twice as much work, or you pick the one that suits you, in which case you always have to ask,
I'm starting to wonder, they're apart by a signal, but since they use the same data.
It's a different reduction of the data?
But it's still, the statement that two measurements are within one sigma of each other usually has merit if they were completely independent analysis on completely different data. And so if it's the same data, which I didn't appreciate when I said that earlier, it should be closer than one sigma. Being one sigma apart is not a figure.
So what I would need to do is go and compare point by point, like timestamp by timestamp, how similar the actual RVs were from the different pipelines. I don't know how different they are.
If the points themselves.
Yeah.
But even the points themselves being different when it's the same data, I don't know.
Pipeline.
I don't know what the figure of merit is for that, but I think it's less than a sigma.
It's
sort of complicated, right? Because if your pipeline introduces differences, then the thing you care about is how are those differences correlated,
right?
So for instance, if you start the production process with a random seed.
Right.
That's right. So you want to take simulate data.
Yeah.
And shove it through these pipelines and see as there are these how well do they trace each other.
Okay, so Jen, you have 15 minutes.
Got it.
If there's anything you really want to cover, maybe you
should. So I have two more papers I wanted to talk about. This one I'll just breeze through. Basically, I just wanted to say this is another multi-planet system. This one has three planets. The star is much fainter. It's 11.7 in V. And so it will be more challenging to get the masses of these planets. But another system where you have multiple planets, actually all of these are kind of on the low side of the radius gap, but different periods, different radii, how might their compositions compare? How does that compare to the star? This is just another test case for that. And then Sam Quinn has another like five planet system paper. So TESS is finding these multi-planet systems. And then I wanted to end with a paper that isn't about planets, but it's about stars. That might host planets, probably do. And so this is a paper that's looking at this huge sample of M dwarfs that TESS is observing. And so this plot is showing the distribution of, this must just be stars, it must not be planet host stars, from Kepler, versus TUS, or no, these are flares, flare detection. So this, the gray stars are from James Davenport's flare detection paper from the Kepler sample, and then this paper is looking at has the blue stars, and so they're saying, look what TESS is doing. It has a much larger fraction of M dwarfs that it's observing, and we can get all sorts of interesting information about the flares, the energy, the flare rate, as a function of spectral type at the lower end. And so, yeah, they go through the search for how to find flares. Again, if that's something that interests you, I encourage you to check out this paper. But I liked this plot because, so they have these separated into by spectral type and then by whether they detected a rotation period in the TESS data or in ground-based photometry, or they didn't. That's other. And then these like colored lines are fits through these are each stars, fits through these points. This is the energy of the flare versus the rate of the flare that is at that energy or higher, I guess. But they go into this little discussion in the paper about, well, like flares might seem like a bad thing. And yes, in these like red boxes, this is really, really bad for ozone. This is less bad, but probably still not good for having an ozone layer around a planet. That's gonna knock it out. But these greens, which are kind of, I think, supposed to be corresponding to each of the colored points. This is where for each star, the green is where that might actually enhance prebiotic chemistry for planets around that star. I forget if they assumed a certain rotation or orbital period for the planet. And so there's like this kind of drastic change from like bad, 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 but maybe this is good. And this is a region that it would be like okay to have flares, maybe even good to have flares. And it might help drive what they call prebiotic chemistry. Again, I forget all the details, but that was an interesting take on all the flare statistics that they now have for these stars.
Why is the distribution on that left panel trimodal?
On the left panel, yeah. Here?
Yeah, you see
on
the top.
Yeah. So this is the Kepler data set, and I think, yeah, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead. That's Kepler, that's not TESS.
This is gray is Kepler, and blue is TESS in this paper. And so I think Kepler just didn't observe that many of the lower mass stars, and I don't know offhand like whether this was known that the flare rate in, you know, mid K's was expected to be so high, but
these are what's being plotted here. Those are systems with flares.
With flares, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
I'm surprised there's so many F zero stars with flares.
Yeah.
But how would the target set up in this step? Is there going to bias in the selection of targets?
Huge ones, right?
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Sure. And this is not a bias corrected plot.
And the other thing to say about those F0 stars, that is saying flares are detected at the location of an F0 star,
yes,
in the catalog. It doesn't mean the F0 star produced the flare. A lot of those F0
right.
stars will have M dwarf companions.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah, but then why would you get a peak at F0 and not at all masses? Why wouldn't you also have M dwarfs around G0 stars that are flaring?
Maybe it's easier to see the M dwarfs around the G0 stars. Like you would know that they were there.
I would think they'd be WASP easier on the G0 because the G0 is dimmer.
So the WASP search found more M dwarfs eclipsing F stars than G0 stars. I know the statistics behind it, but there's this whole program to follow up with what they think are planets, but they turn out to be M dwarfs actually went behind the F star or in front of the F star.
They tend to be later.
Later.
Oh.
Yeah, they tend to be later. Mm. I don't know what that picking F0 is.
Also, I
don't
know where the spectral types come from.
Yeah, also a good question.
That's a good point.
Anyway, so those were kind of just quick highlights. I have like lists and other papers that I thought were interesting. These are more star papers. There's at least two papers now that, have neural network or kind of deep learning identification of TESS planet candidates. And so one of my to-dos is to go and read those. So anyway, lots of TESS science. super excited.
You didn't talk about your idea.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So I thought maybe you'd ask. So this is TOI-186 or HD21749. This was a system that Tess observed, at least in the first three sectors, I think it's close to the continuous viewing zone, so it may be collecting more data. Diana Dragomir was the lead on this paper. I'm the second author because we had a lot of RV data. And this was actually a target in our long-term just RV search, as it was for HARPS. And so this data set consists of some archival RVs, but then also additional new RVs, at least from instrument I use, PFS, maybe also from HARPS. We can look in a second. Yeah, I think that's true. So there's this kind of sub-Neptune-sized planet, interestingly on an orbit of roughly 36 days, and so that's longer than a TESS sector. So this is just like the artist's pretty picture. It doesn't actually tell you anything. That meant that I think they saw the transit in the first sector, but then not in the second, or in the second it was like right after a momentum dump. And so for a little while we thought this was a single transit system where you only get one transit in TESS, and that's what Diana's very interested in. And so she really wanted to look at our RV data. Then they saw a second transit of the longer period planet, and also upon folding all three sectors of data, this other signal popped out, which is what the press release was about yesterday, a roughly Earth size, a little bit less than Earth size transiting planet. As you can see, we do not see that in the RVs. The signal is too low. I forget what the predicted signal is, but it's something like 1 meter per second, maybe less. But we have this pretty nice detection of the longer period sub-Neptune-sized planet. So there's HARPS pre-fiber upgrade, HARPS post-fiber upgrade in red, and then with instrument we use, the Planet Finder Spectrograph on Magellan, in February 2017, we put in a new detector, which has better sampling, and then also started using a smaller slit, a narrower slit, and so we have higher resolution spectra. And so what I really like is, like, you look at the kind of purpley points here, then you look at the dark purple points, boom, 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 such small errors. Like, this is very exciting just for the performance of the instrument. Also, my grad student Aaron Flowers made these nice plots that show these are the locations of our long-term survey targets in TESS. And so we think, actually there's a target that was just released that we also have long-term survey data on. And so there's this overlap now between, you know, uninformed RV surveys and TESS. Okay, however, the plot thickens. So looking at this side, these are the periodograms of radial velocities, the calcium H and K, H alpha, and then this is KELT photometry. And you'll see that these are not the ones in the paper, because this is using additional data that we've gained. The data in the paper was just through December of last year. But you see this purple line is the calcium H and K from our instrument. And I guess that's the same for the H index. And then blue is, dark blue is HARPS. Anyway, point being, this is period of planet B. Line, very similar, very close. Also in the photometry, right? And so how well do we really know the stellar rotation period? How is it influencing the signal that we're deriving from the planet? Now you add in our additional, I think this is including January and February data, and the dark purple points are like separating along this fit. And so is like some beating happening between the stellar rotation period and the planet? We're not sure what's going on. We're getting more data. And so the story is more complicated than I think the first paper suggests. We wanted to get it out soon, and like that's fine. I'm not saying it's wrong. Every system is like a beautiful little jewel or intricate butterfly that you want to just study forever. And this is an example of there's more to be learned.
What's the star? Does the 35 days agree as an indication period for?
For the type, for the, yeah, I don't remember offhand, but yeah, it's.
The first slide you said had a temperature of 7,700, but a mass of 0.8.
No, it's in Fahrenheit.
Oh, I didn't make this slide.
That's extreme.
Yeah, I forget the. I think it's slightly hotter than solar. Or no, I think it's slightly cooler than solar. not a supernova, supernova summer hot.
Can we have the field light temperature on that?
Yeah.
Put on some.
So that's all that star is a 35-day big sense for the
yeah. Yeah, 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 yeah. But, like, you know, Diana was very insistent that the rotation period of the star was not the same as the planet. And, like, there is not a peak in the RVs at that, like, slightly, it's like 38 days or something, stellar rotation period. And so she was, like, very insistent that, yes, they're very close, but they're not the same. And I'm just not 100% sure that how confidently we can be about
the
that.
Solar differential rotation.
Exactly. Yes. Exactly. So anyway, that's why the story is complicated.
Do you think that planet B might not really be there?
No, I don't think that it's not there. I'm just not sure that we're measuring the mass. I don't know how accurate the mass is.
And are there not simultaneous tests? The observations, the test observations are not simultaneous with RVs, are they?
They were almost simultaneous. Not so this new data, again, I forget exactly what camera it's in, so I don't remember if Tess is continuing to observe it. This includes observations from, like, the archival is many, many years, right? But then the new observations are October and December of last year.
On the first slide, which camera it's in.
Oh, yeah, maybe. Oh, yeah, so Tess should be, I think that means that Tess should have more data on it.
Although with that long period, I mean, it's going to be hard to measure a rotation period with Tess because you're only going to get one or two cycles.
Yeah.
You're going to get less than one cycle per sector.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, we got lucky with the transit of the planet that there are at least two measured.
You've got some what data?
Hmm?
You can try stitching. It'll be...
Yeah.
Possible. It's doable, but
yeah. Well, so there's years of KELT of the KELT ground based photometry.
Yeah, that's true. They're seeing it.
Yeah.
There's no uncertainty for recently in planet C, is that because we can not constrain it at all?
Correct. We can set a upper limit on the semi amplitude and the mass, but that's that assumes zero eccentricity. There's not enough. We're continuing to monitor the system, and so maybe we might be able to put better constraints, but I probably not on the eccentricity. I would be surprised.
Can you this is what theorists do, right? You just run it to an end by
yeah.
code.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Is it stable or not? Yeah, we could do that.
So how are these type of systems typically in terms of the inner planet? Is it coming to find zero eccentricity, or do you expect them to have eccentricity?
I think they're often very consistent with zero.
No,
yeah.
So knowing that you're a little skeptical of planet B's mass, are you okay with the eccentricity that they assume?
It's consistent with zero, so.
Okay, so.
Maybe with more data, maybe we could also place a better constraint on the eccentricity of planet B.
I'd just like to revisit one point we've come across, actually.
Yeah.
This thing where we had two solutions for the same star.
Yeah, yeah.
Sometimes that's the right thing to do, because those can have different assumptions, right?
Yes.
So it could be that the reason for that difference could be because in one they've assumed that the radial velocities are correlated with H and K, and the other they have assumed that they're not.
Or they could just use different priors on...
Exactly, right. So those differences could be down to perfectly reasonable assumptions. And so actually, if you want to know which one of those is correct, what you would need to do is understand the influence of the stars on the radial velocities better. So you need to have, like, get together a group of people who knew about stars and planets and discuss, you know, what would be a reasonable assumption for the radial velocity of the stars.
So we have work.
Oh, and all the papers that don't have a year, they're all 2019. So if this, and I can maybe put these somewhere, like, so if you want to go and look up the references, you can. The slides. Perfect.
Thank you, Joanna.
Yes. Yes. Yay.